She sensed that her head was still attached to her shoulders, but that was about the only good thing Luminara could be certain of when she finally regained consciousness. Her arms were tightly tied behind her, and her legs bound at thigh, calf, and ankle. Daylight was all she could detect through the soft, permeable hood that covered her head. She could breathe, but only through her nose, as the gag that had been expertly positioned in her mouth kept her from enunciating anything more eloquent than a grunt. Still, that was enough to provoke answering grunts from nearby. She thought she recognized Obi-Wan and Barriss. Anakin, she wasn't certain about, but the muffled, high-pitched Ancyonian noises most likely originated from Kyakta and Bulgan. Evaluating different tones finally convinced her that Anakin, too, was among the imprisoned. A voice that was not smothered by a gag quieted the communal mumbling.
"Good morning, my honorable guests. I have to thank you for what is going to prove a most profitable evening. For me, not for you," Bayuntu concluded contentedly. "The Baroki Overclan you seek lies but a few days' ride north of here, but you won't get to meet with them. Instead, we've embarked on a leisurely journey to the city of Dashbalar, where my clan always does good business."
Luminara could hear him striding back and forth in front of them, preposterously parading his triumph before prisoners unable to see.
"I'm sure you're wondering what's going to happen to you. You should relax. Aja, I would not think of harming you. To do so would be to violate every tenet of Kulun hospitality."
Luminara could sense, if not see, him grinning.
"There are many means by which word can travel quickly over the plains. It is said that if the return to Kupanam of certain off-world visitors could be delayed for two parts of a breeding cycle, a great reward would be paid. These visitors were carefully described. You can therefore imagine my surprise and delight when you appeared outside our camp asking for directions to the Baroki. I was overjoyed when you agreed to accept my hospitality. You will now have the opportunity to experience it at length."
She felt him approach. His musky body odor grew stronger, and his tone darkened.
"While I was told not to harm you, but only to delay your return to the city, I must warn you. Don't make me angry by trying anything that might impact on my profits. As we travel, you will be kept comfortable, but several of my best people will be watching you at all times. At the first sign of Jedi tricks, the perpetrator will be shot. Yes, we ignorant people of the plains know about the Force. Don't make me have to do anything we will both regret."
Luminara sensed the return of the smile as he stepped away from her.
"It would devalue my clan's reputation as traitors. And please, no theatrical attempts to escape. I would take it personally."
"As soon as one of us gets loose, you'll take something personally," Luminara thought furiously. She forced herself to remain calm, to fall back on her training. Every Jedi knows that anger muddies clear thinking, and that revenge is, at best, an archaic waste of energy. Someone didn't want them returning soon to Kupanam. How long was two parts of a breeding cycle? What would be the point in holding them captive and then letting them go? Behind the blinding cloth, her eyes widened slightly. The Unity Council. She and Obi-Wan had promised them an agreement with the Alwari. When they failed to return within a reasonable period of time, the position of those on the Council in favor of secession would grow steadily stronger. Would they vote for secession without waiting for the Jedi to report? Like any politicians, the Council representatives had constituencies to answer to. They wouldn't wait forever. They might not even wait longer than two parts of a breeding cycle. Certainly someone thought that was the case. Who stood to gain the most by preventing the Jedi from completing their mission? Who, besides the already committed secessionists? Who had sponsored the attack against her and Barriss, and then had directed the Padawan's abduction? Though her nostrils were not as sensitive as those of a Subatar, she felt sure she smelled the distant presence of essence of a Hutt. Tuki watched from within the high grass as the Kulun broke camp. Houses and a couple of trading buildings were neatly folded in upon themselves, goods stowed, the miscellany of a nomad clan carefully packed away. Trailing the procession were spare sandames and, more importantly, the 6 riding subatars that were owned by his new friends. When the caravan began to move out, he moved with them, tailing the procession from a distance. Gradually, he became bolder, slipping progressively closer to the convoy. Greater proximity enabled him to pick out individuals while still keeping under cover. He recognized a number of the clan folk. Foremost among them was the rotund Bayuntu. The chieftain rode in the front of the procession, borne aloft on a platform decorated with colored streamers that snapped briskly in the steady breeze, handmade wind organs, kulun pennants, and gaudy advertisements for the clan's trade goods. So occupied was Tuki with monitoring the clan's movements and keeping hidden that he almost forgot why he was risking his life to do so. But he jumped for joy when, later that afternoon, his friends were brought out of a transport pulled by 8 Sandanes. One at a time, they were exposed to the wind, sun, and fresh air. After a modest interval, each was returned to the concealment of the transport, and his or her place on the front bench seat taken by another. Trembling with excitement, he watched and counted patiently. They were all there, the 4 Jedi, as well as the 2 spiteful Talki Alwari. Based on what he could see from his hiding place in the grass, none of them appeared to have been harmed. They were hooded, gagged, and bound securely enough to control even a Jedi. Blob Butt Bayuntu might be a liar and a sneak, but he certainly knew what he was doing. How in the name of the rain gods was he going to free them? Tuki wondered. First he would have to slip into their camp. Then he would somehow have to deal with guards. Kulun guards, bigger and stronger than himself. He had nothing to use for a weapon except rocks. Every step, every forward lurch of the plodding Sandanes he was following took him farther from home, from the safety of familiar hills and the warmth of the Gwurin tribe. He tried not to think about how far he was from everything he knew. Water was not a problem, rain having collected in small pools and depressions in the hard-packed prairie dirt. But he had to spend time searching for food, and then would have to hurry to catch back up to the steadily advancing caravan. Days passed in this fashion, then another and another. Tired and filthy and homesick, he nevertheless somehow managed to keep up with the procession. Yet another evening saw him no closer to a possible way of rescuing his friends than when he had hidden in the Kolot burrow. As night fell, tired and hungry, he once again sought shelter from marauding predators, and found himself having to move farther and farther away from the encampment. He regretted the loss of light from the camp's glow poles, even if they could only be safely viewed from a distance. But safety was more important than a cheery glow in the night. If not a burrow or a high tree, he would have to find some big rocks he could squeeze between before he allowed himself to rest. What he encountered instead was a distant rumbling and booming. "Oh, Pifgot," he mumbled. As if his present situation wasn't bad enough, now it was going to rain. Pretty hard, too, judging by the smell of it. Wind swirled around him as if suddenly unsure of what direction to take, and the taste of impending moisture was heavy on the night air. Capchanaga boomed off to the north, announcing his advance with steady earthward thrusts of the light that burned. There, in front of him in the darkness, an unexpected ridge of hills. Just in time, too, judging from the rising wind. A flash of Capchanaga's breath briefly lit up the sky. Tuki froze. These were not hills he was silently approaching. He knew that was the case not only because of what he had seen in that split second of illumination, but because the hill he was nearest to had turned a baleful eye in his direction. Lorquaw. So startled was he that he couldn't decide whether to curl up on the ground, turn and run, or simply topple over unconscious. As a consequence, he did none of these. Instead, he just stood where he was, staring, as the rain began to fall in earnest. The sound of it pattering against the grass was familiar and soothing, but did nothing to remove the threat of the moaning mountains that loomed massively before him. The Lorqual were, at least insofar as the Gwyrran knew, the biggest inhabitants of the plains. Though they stood only slightly taller at their two sets of shoulders than did the Subatar, the Lorqual were far more massive. A single mature adult would weigh as much as four Subatars. Their strange, stiff, brown and beige fur stuck straight out from their sides, giving them a bristly appearance. Lightning was flashing more frequently now, allowing him a better view of the herd. He judged it to be sizable, though it was impossible to gauge its full extent. That was when he had the idea. It could as easily kill him as make him a hero. But after 3 days of hard scrambling through high grass, over rocky places, and down clammy mud holes, it was the first idea he'd had. That it might also be his last weighed heavily on him. It very likely might not even work. Bending, he made a Gwyrran gathering basket out of the driest grass he could find. It was something taught to every young member of the tribe, so he had no trouble performing the task in the dark, his nimble fingers weaving the grass stems together with the effortlessness of long practice. Advancing slowly and carefully through the falling rain so as not to disturb the highly sensitive Lorqual, he began searching for something else. Even in the rain, it did not take long for him to find what he wanted. A basket full of stones, each somewhat rounded, and each of a size to fit comfortably in his long-fingered hand. The easy part of his idea fulfilled, he now had no choice but to proceed to the much more difficult and dangerous. Two shafts of the light that burns brillianted the underside of fast-moving clouds. More nervous than usual because of the now raging storm, the herd stirred uneasily. Thunder boomed. As it did so, he took careful aim and threw the first stone. It struck its intended target just above the left eye. Letting out a startled howl of distress that sounded like a moaning moon, the Lorqual next to the one on which he was standing rose and kicked out with its front legs, keeping the middle and rear pairs firmly planted on the ground. A distressed bellowing rose from those huddled nearby. A second stone, flung in the wake of the first, struck another member of the assembled herd. It also jerked and kicked out. A third rock hit the biggest Lorqual of all, right in the eye. The herd began to surge back and forth, uncertain how to react or what to do next. Among the animals clustered around Tuki, panic began to spread like a wave, ripples of alarm racing toward the outer edges of the mob. He kept chucking stones, continuing to agitate those animals within his throwing range. The mewling roar grew steadily louder, rising even above the rolling thunder and driving rain. Confused and uncertain, fearful and concerned, Lorqual bumped up against jittery Lorqual. Then, Capchanaga lent a hand in the form of several bolts of the light that burns. With the last closest strike, the herd abandoned all semblance of restraint. Beneath him, the earth itself trembled under the impact of the quickening Lorqual. The Kulun encampment was silent, dark save for the usual all-night glow poles that were set out to show any nocturnal amblers the way between structures. Thunder rattled the raindrops, then resounded again. A picket suddenly blew a distress call on his horn. Multiplying alarms reverberated throughout the camp. Everyone woke up, some quickly, others more slowly, wiping at their wide eyes. Within the visitor's transport, Luminara tried to mumble a question through her gag, but failed to make herself understood. She sensed movement all around her as her equally securely bound friends struggled to sit up. There was no mistaking the reality of the disturbance, though. The turbulence was not in the force. It was in the ground itself. Buckling his loose-legged pants around him, a rapidly awakening Bayuntu was bawling orders in every direction. Around him, throughout the camp, all was loosely organized chaos. Rising above the storm, the cries of squealing Sadanes, trampled riders, and injured Lorqual combined to create an agonized cacophony the likes of which had not been heard on that section of the prairie in some time. Gigantic six-toed feet trampled trade goods and outbuildings, fracturing lightweight composite walls and sending those huddled within fleeing, screaming into the rain-swept night. Great horned heads swung from side to side, tossing Kulun and animals flying. Crazed by dread, driven by lightning and bleeding from gunshots, the Lorqual smashed their way through the fractured, splintering, increasingly chaotic camp. There were no longer any guards outside the visitors' transport. Like the rest of the clan, they had rushed to the assistance of their friends and families, desperate to save lives and livelihoods. Scrambling up the front of the transport, a dripping wet Tuki let himself inside. Within, sitting up and struggling with their bonds, were his friends. To all outward appearances, they were still safe and unharmed. That much he had expected. All Kulun traders worthy of the clan name would do their best to ensure that their goods were not damaged. Searching for something stronger than bare fingers to work with, he found the strange off-worlder equipment neatly stacked and labeled in an unlocked storage case near the front of the transport. Reaching first for one of the lightsabers, he thought better of it and settled instead for a small, versatile Alwari blade that belonged to Bulgan. A knife he knew how to use. Small but strong hands went to work on Barriss's bonds. When the Padawan's hood was pulled off and she saw who had come to rescue them, she hardly knew what to say. Which was just as well, since she remained gagged while Tuki started in on her wrists and ankles.
"Tuki, tell truth!"
the Gurren jabbered away non-stop as he worked.
"Tuki, bravest of his people! The strongest, the fiercest, the wisest!"
"The most talkative," Barriss interrupted him when she could finally remove the gag. Freed, she found that she was unable to move. Days of tight bondage had left her muscles cramped, the nerves tingling. Jedi schooling helped her restore her circulation far more rapidly than an untrained prisoner would have been able to manage. The busy Tuki told her where their gear was stored. With two of them working together, they soon had Obi-Wan, Luminara, and Anakin untied. Something slammed into the left side of the transport and nearly knocked it over on its side. Rising above wind and rain, a stentorian moaning reached them from outside. It was accompanied by the ragged shouts of thoroughly unnerved Kulun. "What was that?" Anakin demanded to know as he rubbed circulation back into his legs.
"Lorqual!"
Tuki was sawing away at the material binding Kiakta's ankles.
"To fight Kulun! Tuki need big stick."
He looked up long enough to smile smugly.
"Lorqual heard big stick. Tuki stampede them this way."
Kiakta gaped down at the Gwaran.
"You stampeded a whole herd of Lorqual toward us? We could have all been flattened."
As if attesting to the validity of the guide's observation, something banged hard into the transport a second time. The Gwaran glanced over at the guide.
"Big mouth Alwari maybe should flatten mouth lips a little. Also sit still, otherwise possible Tuki have accident and cut off toes."
Within moments, every one of them stood tall once again, their equipment and their freedom restored. Lightsaber in hand, Luminara moved guardedly to the front of the transport and peered out. Glowpoles rocked in their stands and frightened Kulun ran to and fro, while the pelting rain continued to obscure much of what might otherwise be seen. Looming above all was the swaying, head-swinging, immense bulk of a single, badly disoriented, and very angry Lorqual. Force, she thought. If that was one Lorqual, what must a stampede of them look like? Glancing back, she caught sight of the agitated but determined form of Tuki squeezed in among the others. "Whatever happens from now on, Tuki, I want you to know that I and Obi-Wan and our Padawans think you are very brave indeed."
"Not just brave, brave, brave."
The Gwaran started to step forward, then shrank back as the rampaging Lorqual head-butted a sizable water cistern in their direction. It exploded against the ground nearby, adding a little more liquid to the wind-driven downpour.
But right now, just a little scared.
Undimmed by the pounding rain, shafts of bright artificial light illuminated opposite sides of the corral. They wove graceful, elegant arcs of luminous lethality that were clearly visible through the darkness and damp. Slipping through the fence, Obi-Wan gestured silently toward the farther of the two guards standing watch on their side of the perimeter. Both Kulun were hardened from years of fighting off marauding predators and raiding clans. Their senses were sharp, their fighting skills acute. The one who turned first overcame his surprise at the sight of the two oncoming humans in time to raise his rifle and fire a single burst. Deflected by the unnaturally swift parry of Obi-Wan's lightsaber, the bolt went flaring off into the night. Before the sentry could get off a second shot, the Jedi had taken him down. At first, Obi-Wan thought his Padawan might be having some trouble with the other guard. When he saw that Anakin was only toying with him, the Jedi frowned and started toward the battling pair. As soon as he saw his master approaching, Anakin finished off his opponent with a quick cut to the neck. The Kulun collapsed into the muddy short grass. Deactivating his lightsaber, Obi-Wan looked down at the dead Ancionian, then up at his Padawan. Though a burst of lightning threw their faces and bodies into sharp relief, it could not illuminate the tension between them. "What was that about, Padawan?" The Jedi's voice was perfectly uninflected. "Nothing, Master." His face a mask of innocence, Anakin belted his lightsaber. "He was faster than I thought." Kenobi considered his pupil in silence. Then he nodded, once. "Have a care, Anakin, lest next time your opponent is even faster than that." Stepping past the Padawan, he gestured curtly. "Come on, we've lost too much time here already." A sharp whistle drew Luminara and Barriss to them. Silently, the group mounted their restless subatars. As they did so, both Kyakta and Bulgan took note of the lifeless bodies of the four Kulun sentinels. Luminara's animal reared nervously on its hind and middle legs, and she fought to control it while staying in the saddle. A few weeks ago, she would surely have been thrown. But with time had come experience, and with experience, confidence. Getting the towering beast back under control, she followed the guides as they urged their mounts northward. Firm hands and proper guidance restored to them, the bounding subatars cleared the electrified barrier of the portable corral easily. Then they were out in the rain, racing northward across the prairie. Somewhere ahead lay the elusive Overclan and the closing stages of their mission. They paused for the night by one of the innumerable small streams that notched the grasslands. There had been no sign of pursuit by Bayuntu's Kulun. Either they had suffered so seriously from the nocturnal stampede of the Lorqual that they were unable to mount a chase, or else they had decided that it was not worth hunting prisoners who could strike back without being seen. "There's another possibility, too," Kyakta pointed out when the matter was broached. "The closer we draw to the Overclan, the less inclined a lesser clan like the Kulun would be to risk interfering." "What matters is that we seem to be safe." Obi-Wan squinted at the setting sun. "Still, we'll mount guard tonight, just to be sure." Anakin was glad when his turn came to stand watch. It was late, after midnight Ancion time, when Barriss came to shake him awake. A touch was all that was necessary.
"Nothing to report,"
she whispered so as not to wake the others. As he rose and donned his upper clothing, she was already slipping tiredly into her sleep sack.
"You don't see anything out there, but you can hear it moving around. This world is full of furtive night sounds that live in the grass."
He couldn't be certain, but he thought she was asleep before she closed her eyes. The lookout location had been carefully chosen by their Alwari guides. It was the highest point near their campsite, and only a very slight rise at that, a mere hiccup in the ground. Still, it provided the nearest thing to an actual vantage point within walking distance of the stream. Finding a firm, comfortable place to stand, he settled down to wait out his 3-hour shift.
Most individuals would have found the duty unutterably boring. Not Anakin. Raised by a single parent, without any siblings, he was used to being by himself. For a long time as a child, machines had been his only company. Except for the absence of walls, there really wasn't much difference between retreating to the back of a machine shop and standing alone on an alien prairie beneath an alien sky. One of Ancyon's two moons was up and the other still rising, a pair of curved slivers glowing silver against a background of black velvet. They were framed by a scattering of stars like diamonds. So many worlds, so many questions, with many of the latter focused upon the world on which he was presently standing. Something rustled in the high grass. Glancing sharply in that direction, he saw nothing. As Barriss had told him prior to retiring, this planet was full of tiny, creeping night sounds. Entire communities of lesser local life lived out their lives below the crests of the waving wild grains without ever exposing themselves to sight or daylight. One could only wonder at what kind of havoc a stampede of Lorqual would wreak on such hidden animal societies. Probably not much, he told himself. Out here, in these wild open spaces, nature accommodated the needs of the small as well as the large. Tuki's tribe was a good example of that. Plucky little soul, that Tuki. Annoying and overly inquisitive, to be sure, but as bold as his boastings. Having been forced to live most of his life on boldness alone, Anakin greatly admired the quality in others. An hour passed before he was again disturbed by rustling noises. Each day added another couple of previously unencountered native species to his growing catalogue of Ancyonian life. But the register of nocturnal creatures was, for obvious reasons, considerably smaller. Having nothing else to do, he decided he might as well try to find out what was making the soft sounds in the grass. Whatever it was, it sounded conveniently close. Turning to his left, he crouched slightly and began to move deeper into the tall prairie. The crackling noise came again, closer still. A small group of local animals, he concluded, busily gathering fallen grass seed under cover of night. It would be interesting to learn what they looked like. At least one of them sounded like it might be of fairly good size, perhaps even as big as Tuki. Surprised in mid-stalk, the Shan exploded from its place of concealment. It didn't growl. Like so many of Ancyon's indigenous life forms, it hissed. The hiss of a Shan was not like that of an intelligent Alwari, however, or some of the endearing creatures that roamed the vast open plains. It was a low, sinister blast of air, fury made audible. Front and middle paws slammed into Anakin's chest, knocking him backward and down. In an instant, the Shan's heavy, fang-laden jaws would have been on his throat. There was no time to think, no time to decide what to do next, no time to ponder a best course of action. As the Shan's jaws descended, he rolled madly to his right. The predator's upper row of backward-curving, serrated teeth slammed into bare dirt instead of his neck. Furious, the lithe, muscular carnivore turned to face its prey, all six legs working, single nostril flared wide, convex red eyes floating like small, livid moons against the dark mass of the brute's front shoulders. Scuttling backward on hands and feet, Anakin tried to focus the force while reaching urgently for his lightsaber. Drawing it from his belt, he activated the beam and had it slapped from his right hand by one triclawed paw. Landing in nearby grass, the device struck on its control side and switched off. That was what came, a small part of him reflected, of trying to do two things at once without knowing how. A true Jedi could do that. Painfully, he was once again made aware of how much he had yet to learn. If he didn't do something quickly, his learning days would be at a premature end. Weaponless, he rose slowly to his feet. Hissing expectantly, the Shan watched him without blinking. Unlike the Padawan, it was not constrained by a need to think. Muscles bunching tight beneath short, striped fur,
Maw agape, it leapt. Shorn of his only physical weapon, Anakin fell back on what remained to him. Concentrating as he had never concentrated before, he threw one hand out in front of him, fingers splayed, and focused. His command of the Force was not yet sufficient to allow him to knock the charging Shan backward, but it was strong enough to deflect the lethal leap to one side. As it flew past him, the Shan struck out with front and middle claws. One set raked Anakin's shoulder as he threw himself out of the way. He did not cry out. Blood streamed from his torn shoulder. The wound was painful and messy, but not deep. Enraged and confused, the Shan landed on all sixes and immediately whirled to launch itself anew. As it did so, Anakin made a dive for his lightsaber. His fingers closing around the metal cylinder, lying on his stomach, he started to turn to face his furiously hissing adversary. The Shan was a big male, powerful, fast, and hungry. Anakin knew he would only have time for one strike, but with the lightsaber, that should be enough. As he started to turn, something landed hard on his right wrist, pinning it to the ground. Wincing at the pain, he looked up, to find himself staring straight into a second pair of brilliantly reflective red eyes. Not an arm length away, they narrowed as they bored into his own. Anakin's heart dropped toward his diaphragm. The Shan's mate had arrived to join the party. An enormous weight landed on his back. Everything was happening too fast. Using the Force against the Shan had been one thing, but now there were two of them. If he tried to throw off the male now crouching on his back, the female was likely to bite his face off. If he pushed at her and freed his hand and lightsaber, the male would have time to shred his back with its claws or lock its jaws on his neck. Even as he formulated the thought, he knew he was spending too much time thinking. The male Shan emitted a rising hiss, a tormented sound unlike anything it had given voice to so far. At the same time, the weight on the Padawan's back was removed. The Shan had stepped off him for what reason Anakin could not imagine. Thus reduced to a single adversary, he shoved hard with the Force. Grunting in surprise, the female was knocked sideways several body lengths. Arm freed, he activated his lightsaber. Before he could bring it into play, the stunned but still reactive female leapt. She was met in mid-bound by a downward sweeping arc of light that caught her just behind the head. There was a single sharp hiss of surprise and pain, a sudden smell of burned flesh, and she landed on him belly first. Using his muscles, he rose on hands and knees and shook the heavy weight off his back. The big male Shan was lying nearby, motionless, smoke rising from its seared skull. Standing next to it was a single familiar shape. Though not inherently tall, in Anakin's sweat-stung eyes, the looming figure assumed the proportions of a giant. The outsized image vanished in the smile the slowly turning figure bestowed on him. Small sounds often mask large sources. Clad only in her sleeping attire, Luminara unduly deactivated her lightsaber and let it fall to her side. A good lookout needs to listen with more than his or her ears, Anakin Skywalker. Reality is rife with disguises. Breathing hard, he rose shakily to his feet and bowed his head once, hastily. Thank you for my life, Master Luminara. She accepted his thanks with a nearly imperceptible dip of her own head. Your life is your own, Anakin, and not mine to give or take. He thought he detected a twinkle in her eye. I merely helped preserve it. Approaching, she startled him by casually slipping an arm around his back. The feel of it was astonishingly comforting. It reminded him of something nearly forgotten. Come with me. I'll stand the rest of your shift. But you're not due to come on for another hour yet, he protested. Once more, she flashed that warming, knowing smile at him. For some strange reason, I'm suddenly wide awake. It's all right, Padawan. Consider this just another learning experience. One you will learn from, won't you? It was a rhetorical question, one he knew he did not have to acknowledge.
When one hears the sound of a lightsaber springing to life in the middle of the night in a strange place on a strange world, one knows it is not being triggered for purposes of amusement. I believe I reached you just in time.
Feeling better with every step, Anakin nodded agreement.
If anyone wants to ask me, I think I can tell them all they want to know about the collaborative attack tactics of the stalking Shan. Probably more than they would want to know.
They were already back at the camp. Her arm slid off his back.
Get some sleep, Anakin. Don't worry about me. I'm used to this sort of thing.
It would have been churlish of him to protest further. Finding his bed, he fell rather than lay back onto it, not even bothering to slip into the sack. Turning onto his back, wincing at the fiery pain in his shoulder, he considered the stars from a different perspective than he had earlier that night. There was more to mastering the Force than moving objects from point to point. One had to be conscious of it at all times, not just in moments of danger. It was not armor, always present to protect those who knew something of its ways. It responded only to conscious effort, to awareness. That was his problem, he realized. He was aware only part of the time. It wouldn't happen again, he swore. From now on, he would be with the Force at all times, rather than waiting for it to be with him. Yet again, it had been brought home to him how much he did not yet know. Fortunately, he was a fast learner.
Morning saw the group of fast-moving travelers slow as Kyata rejoined them. The guide had ridden on slightly ahead. Now he returned at a gallop, visibly excited, bulging eyes aglow.
Found them,
he announced proudly as he turned his subatar. He extended his artificial arm to point.
Just over the next rise.
At last, Luminara murmured.
You're certain it's the Baroki?
The Alwari gestured emphatically.
No mistaking it, Master Luminara. They are in full ceremonial camp, pennants flying. The Overclan Baroki, most influential of all the Alwari clans.
In truth, it was a more impressive sight than any of them had expected. Having been exposed to the nomad encampments of the Iwa and the Kulun, the travelers believed they had some idea of what to expect. Neither of those previous encounters prepared them for what greeted their eyes as their subatars topped the crest of the low ridge. Spread out before them were not dozens of recently unfolded and erected portable structures, but hundreds. Several boasting sophisticated energy arrays for the generation of power must have required dozens of draft animals to pull them, Luminara reflected. Thousands of Baroki of all ages milled about within the vast, elaborate camp. Beyond, uncountable thousands of herd animals grazed peacefully within perimeters patrolled by Sadane-mounted handlers. The din of their passive moaning and mewling, a kind of rising noise, dominated the sounds of the camp. Here, just as they had been told, resided the supreme power of the Alwari. Where the Baroki led, the rest of the Alwari would follow.
Surep, Bulgan explained in response to her query concerning the herd. Males are the blue ones with the darker neck ruffs and coiled antlers. Females are green and slightly larger, but without the ruffs.
Sitting up straight in her saddle, she let her gaze rove over the impressive panorama.
I've never seen an animal with three eyes lined up vertically like that, instead of in the usual horizontal position.
Top eye keeps watch for flying predators, middle eye tracks fellow Surep, and the bottom eye monitors the ground for food and obstacles.
Bulgan shifted in his seat, the side of his face with the one good eye leaning, as always, slightly forward.
That way the Surep miss nothing.
I see. I suppose it makes sense for an animal that's standing still, but they must have terrible peripheral vision.
The guide nodded.
That is so, but they don't need it. When you almost always have another Surep on either side of you, plus others in front and back, you don't have to see from side to side, only up and down. Up in the lead, Kyakta raised his long-fingered prosthetic. Riders are coming. Unsurprisingly, there were six of them. Six by now being readily recognized by the travelers as a number of significance for all Ancyonians. More richly attired than Iwa or Kulun, their lightweight armor gleamed in the sun. Clearly, at least some of what they had heard about the Overclans was true, Luminara saw. The Baroki had wealth, and the acumen to know how to spend it. Curiosity overcoming his natural reserve, the leader of the half a dozen riders impelled his equally impressively attired Sadane forward, halting in front of the lead Subatars. The considerable difference in the heights of their respective mounts forced him to look up at the visitors. To his credit, he did not seem in the least intimidated. He was also, Luminara decided, openly friendly, at least on the surface. But then, she knew, the powerful can afford to be magnanimous. "Greetings, off-worlders and friends." The Baroki briefly pressed one hand across his eyes and the other over his chest. "I am Bayar, of the Situng Baroki. Welcome to our camp. What do you wish of the Overclan?" While Obi-Wan explained their purpose, Luminara continued to study the pickets. While their leader listened courteously to Obi-Wan, the members of his troop sat imperiously in their saddles, but their eyes were always moving. Bayar did not have to retire to mull a response when Obi-Wan had finished. "This is not something to which I can speak. I am an outrider, a sentinel, and sentinels do not make decisions of such magnitude." Obi-Wan smiled in that slight knowing way of his and nodded understandingly. "As a kind of sentinel myself, I appreciate your position. We will convey the news of your arrival, as well as your reasons for seeking out the Baroki, to the Council of Elders. Meanwhile, I invite you to follow me and experience Baroki hospitality." So saying, he neatly turned his mount and started back down the gentle slope toward the bustling milling encampment. The differences between the Baroki encampment and anything the travelers had encountered thus far were both striking and immediately apparent. Everything they experienced during the next several hours spoke to the strength of the Overclan. The food was better, the drinks richer, the trimmings and trappings of the visitor's house in every way more lavish than anything they had previously encountered on Ancyon. Truth be told, they enjoyed themselves. After their dubious encounters with the Yiwa and the Kulun, it was a relief to be able to relax in pleasant surroundings, reasonably confident they would not be set upon at any moment by potential assailants. Both Kyakta and Balgan were convinced of that much, though Tuki remained as chary as always. As to the possible response they would receive from the Baroki Council of Elders, the two guides could offer no opinion. Bayar was back well before evening. If the swiftness of his return was encouraging, his words were not. At best, they were ambiguous. "The Council will greet you," the sentinel informed them. Barriss's face broke out into a wide smile. "We're all set, then." As she spoke, Bayar turned his attention to her. "I am not entirely certain what you mean by that, but I think you are confident too soon. When I say that the Council will greet you, that is all they will do. Not to do so would be ill-mannered." While there was plenty of convivial chatter and casual conversation when the group gathered this time, all of the conspirators wore their concerns like jewelry. Despite the overweening air of gaiety, one could cut the tension inside the transport with a knife. Large enough to carry 50 passengers in luxury and comfort, the vehicle was presently conveying half that number, together with their attendant serving droids. Below, the endless world city that was Coruscant gleamed golden in the morning sun as the planet's star rose over the distant irregular horizon of towers and domes. None of the passengers was pleased with the timing of the convocation, but all had agreed to it. There was dissension within the movement, and it had to be resolved. For many of the participants, the time for talking was done with. Those arguing in favor of moving forward now were making their case forcefully, even brusquely. To them, it was not a matter of moving too fast. It was simply that, as far as they were concerned, the time for waiting was at an end. That certainly seemed to be the majority opinion inside the transparasteel-enclosed passenger compartment. As tumblers clinked and expensively attired individuals saluted one another on their forthcoming triumph, one would have thought the Articles of Secession had already been signed and disseminated. Laughter rose above the small talk as jokes were swapped that described the eagerly anticipated reactions of certain well-known and heartily disliked politicians to the declaration that was to come. Among the revelers were a handful who did not join in the hasty celebration. Most notable among these was a prominent Shumai of mild aspect and conciliatory demeanor. Idly, she peered out through the protective transparasteel at the unending panorama of residences and factories, gardens and urban facilities sliding past beneath them. The morning sky was full of similar, if far less well-appointed, vehicles carrying people to and from their places of work and habitation. Billions of them on Coruscant alone, trillions more scattered across the galaxy, the fate of all about to be altered to one degree or another by the decision the handful of sentients in this one transport were on the verge of rendering. It was a great responsibility, she knew. Too much, really, for one individual to ponder. But she was prepared to do so. As president of the Commerce Guild, she was charged with making such decisions. Sooner or later, all sentients were compelled to confront their destiny. Most turned away from it. She intended to fully embrace her own. Someone had to step forward and say what needed to be said. The victory celebration was getting out of hand, especially in the absence of any victory. Working her way to the back of the compartment, Shumai stepped up on a small stool. It wasn't much of a platform, but then this was not the guild she was addressing either. "It's too soon," Shumai proclaimed, loud enough to be heard above the babble, but without shouting. Conversation faded quickly. Everyone turned to look at her. "Too soon," she added in a softer yet still steely tone, "to reveal our real intentions and ourselves." "Excuse me, Shumai," declared a slim but powerful humanoid who stood in the Senate for 3 inhabited worlds. "But not only is it not too soon, it is overdue. We have waited for this moment long enough." The subsequent rising murmur showed just how much support this opinion held among the assembled. Shumai was not intimidated. She never was. The easily intimidated did not become president of an organization like the Commerce Guild. "Everything we have worked for is at stake here. All our preparations, our carefully laid out plans, are at last beginning to coalesce. Nothing will shatter our mutual dream more than to show ourselves prematurely. Nothing will cost us fickle support among those systems still wavering more than delaying unnecessarily," came a contradictory shout from the back of the group. The supportive murmuring rose afresh, even stronger this time. Shumai raised both hands for silence. As she was one of their own, they conceded her their attention, out of respect not for her insistence, but for the power she wielded with the guild. "My friends, you all know me. You know of my devotion and that of the rest of the guild to the cause. We have worked together, planned together, kept secret from the Senate together our carefully designed intentions for many years now. It is the wise animal who waits until the fruit is ripe before eating. Pluck it too soon, and sickness can be the result." A squat, muscular figure pushed its way to the forefront of the group to confront the speaker directly. Shumai found herself looking down at Tam Eulis.
"Wait too long, and the fruit rots."
The industrialist was not smiling.
"We need to move. It feels right."
Shumai stepped down off her dais.
"And are you now basing your decisions on your feelings, my friend?"
"Not of the Force, no. But I know people."
Eulis gestured behind him at the attentive crowd.
"I know these people. They've waited and worked long and hard for this moment. So have I.
I would be the last one here to deny everyone their moment,
Shumai replied softly.
I just want to make sure it's the right moment.
Off to one side, Senator Mosul nodded somber agreement. Looking past Tam Yulis, Shumai raised her voice again.
We have to wait for Ancyon to declare for secession. Ancyon is still the key. Public disgust with the corruption and bureaucracy of the Republic runs high, but even the most sensitive explosive needs a fuse to set it off. Ancyon's withdrawal will serve as the detonator, and its interlocking alliances will bring the Malarians and the Chitomites with it. It will be the excuse we need to move.
The movement is strong enough now, the industrialist objected. We could continue to wait on Ancyon and the others, yes, but in so doing we might well lose other equally vital support. Once we move, Ancyon will follow docilely enough.
Are you sure of that, my friend? Are you certain? Even as we stand here conversing, there are Jedi on Ancyon.
Confused mutterings from the group showed that by no means everyone present was aware of what was happening on that key world.
Jedi working to ensure that Ancyon, and by inference the Malarians and the Chitomites, remain within the Republic.
Ulysses' gaze narrowed.
You and Senator Mosul told me they were being dealt with.
So they are, Shumai assured him. But where Jedi are involved, nothing is certain until it is done. And as soon as the Senator receives word that their efforts have been countered and that the delegates to the unity of towns and cities on Ancyon have voted for secession, we move. But not before. We need Ancyon and the others to declare for withdrawal before we can confidently implement the rest of our plans.
No, someone else in the back insisted. No more waiting! Enough waiting! What matters this week or the next? I say we move now! Ancyon and the others will follow, Jedi or no Jedi.
Jedi or no Jedi?
Shumai's echo of the insistent speaker's proclamation was drowned out by supporting yells and exclamations of approval.
Very well, then. Since the majority of you are clearly in favor of taking action, I have no choice but to concede to the wishes of the majority.
Cheers in several languages filled the compartment.
I ask only that you wait another few days.
A few days? Someone blurted. What difference could a few days make? We move to a turning point in the history of the Republic.
Nearby, the voice of an anxious Senator Mosul rose above the ensuing clamor for action.
As you say, what difference could a few days make?
Confronting his stolid co-conspirators, Ulysses smiled condescendingly.
Since a few days will not make any difference, we will grant them. But,
he added loudly to forestall the incipient rush of protests from those who supported his position,
only a few days. If after that time has elapsed, Ancyon has still not voted, we set in motion that which we have worked toward for so long.
His eyes locked on Shumai's.
Those who do not wish to move with us will have only themselves to blame if they find themselves left behind.
It was not a threat, not in so many words. The president of the Commerce Guild's response was a smile of her own.
I could call for a vote on this here and now, but I am neither blind nor deaf. I see and hear how the wind is blowing. Never let it be said that I was a poor listener. We are agreed, then. We wait a few more days. That should be time enough.
Raising her gaze, she looked past the unwavering industrialist to scan the rest of the expectant group.
I hereby acknowledge your wishes, my friends, and will deal with them, for the betterment of everything we seek.
Jibes turned to cheers. Shumai nodded complacently. She was used to such approbation, and anticipated receiving more of it in the future. A great deal more. Meanwhile, she and Senator Mosul had much to do. The obstinate Tam Yulis had all but guaranteed it. It was hard to believe, after all they had gone through, that the moment, if not of truth, then at least of debating it, had finally come.
Though their clothing was made to repel dirt and grime, it had not been designed to cope with days of hard riding on the back of a giant subatar, not to mention everything else they had experienced. Nonetheless, with the help of Bayar and others of the clan, the four off-worlders managed to render themselves reasonably presentable. When the time came to go before the Baroque Council of Elders, Luminara was convinced they presented as imposing a portrait of roaming Jedi as circumstances would permit. Decorated with pennants, intricate weavings, and imported hangings of worked metal and composite, the meeting house of the Baroque sat off by itself, awaiting their presence. The council consisted of 12 elders of both sexes. They sat on a semicircle of slightly raised, carpeted divans facing the entrance. With a few exceptions, every mane in the room was either white or gray, though some showed striking black spots or stripes. As the off-worlders arrived, one particularly aged Baroque raised a hand in greeting, all three fingers spread wide.
"We welcome you to this Council of the Overclan, and will listen to whatever you have to say. Questions will be asked. It is to be hoped that answers will be imparted."
It was that simple, that straightforward. Obi-Wan made the presentation, repeating what they had already told the Yiwa, the Kulun, and the Gwirin, explaining why they had come to Ancyon, and why it was so important that the Alwari reached agreement with the Senate's proposal. When he was finished, he stepped back and took a seat next to Luminara on a settee provided for the purpose. As befitted their status, Barriss and Anakin sat behind their teachers. His presentation was followed by a good deal of muted but vigorous conversation among the members of the council. One female elder looked up to ask a question worthy of the Kulun.
"We understand what the Alwari are supposed to get if we agree to this proposal. What does the Senate obtain?"
"Assurance that the law will be respected, and that Ancyon will remain within the Republic," Luminara replied without hesitation.
"As goes Ancyon, so will go the Malarians and the Kaitumites. The integrity of the Republic will be preserved."
"But Ancyon is not a powerful world," another of the elders pointed out. "Why so much attention to our internal problems, our border disputes with the people of the Unity and so on?"
"A small crack can lead to the collapse of a huge dam," Obi-Wan told him.
"True, Ancyon itself is not powerful, but it is entangled in powerful alliances. These need to be preserved within the framework of the Republic."
Another elder was speaking.
"If we agree to what you ask, how can we be assured the city folk of the Unity will not go back on their word?"
"The Republic will guarantee the arrangements between you," Luminara told them, to which she added quickly, to forestall intimations of rising laughter, "and so will the Council of Jedi Knights."
That announcement was met with murmurs of evident satisfaction.
"We will also see to it that you are not taken advantage of by the incursions of the Commerce Guild, the Trade Federation, or anyone else."
There were more questions, some general and friendly, others pointed and challenging. When at last there was nothing more to be said, the senior elder of the Situng Baroque raised a shaky hand.
"Retire in peace, friends from another prairie. We will give you your answer before the setting of the sun. Rest assured it will not be given in haste, nor thoughtlessly."
Looking to right and left, she regarded her fellow elders.
"This is a decision that will affect not only the Baroque, but every member of every clan, from the newborn to the dying. It must be taken with care."
As was so often the case in matters of diplomacy, the summit itself was much easier to deal with than the waiting that ensued. There was nothing for the off-worlders to do but retire to the visitor's house. As they waited, they were badgered by Tuki and, to a lesser extent, by the equally inquisitive Kyakta and Bulgan for details of the meeting. The Gwirin in particular was especially entertaining or annoying, depending on one's mood of the moment. When Bayar finally entered, everyone turned immediately in his direction. Taken momentarily aback by the attention, his expression was unreadable. When at last he spoke, it was with uncharacteristic solemnity. The elders are ready to see you again. He stepped aside. Please come with me. The two Jedi exchanged a glance, then followed the sentinel out the door. As before, Anakin and Barriss trailed behind, conversing softly among themselves. So they've come to a decision. Anakin shortened his stride so Barriss could keep up. About time.
Always impatient you are, she told him, mimicking Master Yoda. Better to live a calmer life and a longer one it is.
No calm in my life have I had, say I, he shot back without missing a beat.
His smile was unreadable. I would know how to react if I wasn't on edge most of the time. Glowpoles showed the way to the meeting house. Not candles or oil lamps, but modern illuminators brightened the interior. The visitors arranged themselves before the council. The senior female present began cordially enough.
All this day we have been considering your request. From what we have heard, and from our conversation with you, we of the Barroki believe that the word of the Jedi can be trusted.
Luminara allowed herself to feel a modicum of accomplishment.
We therefore, the female continued, have decided to accede to everything you ask. We of the Barroki will make this peace with the city folk of the Unity, and Ancion will remain within the Republic.
Nearby, Luminara could see Anakin nudge Barriss expectantly. Both Padawans could not keep themselves from grinning joyfully. Obi-Wan's expression, on the other hand, never changed.
In return for this, we ask only that you do one thing for us, the female said.
If it is within our ability, Luminara replied guardedly. The senior male took up the dialogue.
The Jedi are known, even here, as supreme fighters.
When he leaned forward, she noted that what remained of his mane was entirely gray.
Our traditional enemies, the Janul Overclan, are encamped not far from here. Help us deal with them once and for all, and you will have earned the friendship and concordance of the Situng Barroki forever. This is our price for doing what you ask of us.
The smiles vanished from the faces of the two Padawans. Had she been standing, Luminara would have rocked back on her heels. Of all the requests the Barroki might have put to them, of all the challenges and demands, they had chosen one that the Jedi could not possibly grant. It was absolutely forbidden for Jedi to take sides in an internal dispute among individual ethnic, clan, family, or political groups. If the Order was ever seen to be favoring one or another on matters that were no province of the Republic as a whole, its vaunted reputation for even-handedness would be lost. There was no way they could help the Barroki fight and defeat these Janul. No way under the sun. Any sun. A glance showed that Anakin and Barriss realized it as well. Obi-Wan, on the other hand, was nodding solemnly.
Of course we agree. We will be glad to help you deal with your traditional enemies.
Anakin's lower jaw dropped as he gaped at his master. As for Barriss, it was the first time in her apprenticeship that she had ever seen Master Luminara shocked. The Barroki Council was visibly pleased.
Then it is agreed.
The elders rose, some more slowly than others. A few had to be helped to their feet.
The bond is forged. We march tomorrow.
One by one, they filed out of the meeting house. When the last had departed, the visitors followed. They were barely out of the building when Luminara and the Padawans crowded close around Obi-Wan.
What are you thinking? A disbelieving Luminara asked him. How could you promise that? You know we can't take sides in this kind of dispute.
Her voice was tight with frustration and confusion.
We don't have time for this.
The Jedi did not appear in the least upset by her accusatory tone.
We had no choice, Luminara. Either we agreed to help them, or they were going to refuse to sign the treaty we brought with us. They said as much.
But, Master, Anakin put in, the first Janul we kill will prove to this other overclan that the Jedi Knights side with the Barroki. When that happens, the Janul will become our enemies as well. If we help the Baroki defeat them, the Janul survivors will not honor any agreement we put before them. And like the Baroki, an anxious Barriss added, these Janul must have many allies among the Alwari. They'll also refuse to go along with the treaty.
If you'll give me a chance, I'll try to explain, Obi-Wan murmured when the flurry of accusations finally died down.
As they turned a corner, the visitor's house loomed just ahead with its promise of privacy, rest, and refreshment. Though he felt that he knew his teacher better than any of his companions, Anakin still had no idea what his master could have been thinking when he had consented to the elder's request.
What's to explain, master? Either we help these Baroki, as you say we are forced to do in order to gain their cooperation, or else we do not. There are only the two choices.
Looking over at his bewildered Padawan, Obi-Wan Kenobi ventured that knowing thin smile of his and replied softly, No, there is another.
It was a march of several days to the Janul camp. It would have taken much longer had the entire Baroki clan made the move, but only warriors undertook the trek. When at last they ascended a long, low hill overlooking their destination, Luminara saw that the Janul encampment was laid out much the same as that of the Baroki. With its herds and neatly aligned temporary structures, it appeared to be of similar extent. As the designated official contact between the offworlders and the clan, Bayar rode alongside the visitors.
The Janul and the Baroki have been at odds for as long as anyone can remember, he told his new friends. Who should have preeminence among the Alwari has been cause for fighting for hundreds of years.
He looked up at her from the back of his sadain.
While as a warrior of the Situng Baroki, I look forward to victory today. I'm personally sorry the elders saw fit to involve you in this.
Not as sorry as we are, she told him as she directed her subatar to kneel.
Dismounting, she moved to join her companions in the forefront of the Baroki line. Below, the Janul had assembled on the near side of the small river that formed the western border of their camp. Despite the best attempts of the Baroki to achieve surprise, skilled Janul outriders had detected the approach of the column of warriors a day earlier. Drawn up in three lines opposite the hill, the soldiers of the other Overclan stood ready to meet their traditional enemy. Beyond, within the camp, controlled chaos was the order of the day. Businesses were being shut tight, children herded into homes, and groups of reserves positioned among the many mobile buildings. Farther out on the prairie, the great herds of Surep were being watched over by armed adolescents too young to participate directly in the anticipated forthcoming battle.
Many were going to die this day, Bayar knew as he surveyed the Baroki's opponent. But with the help of the powerful offworlders, his clan would prevail. Today's battle, he felt instinctively, would decide which clan among the Alwari was going to predominate for a long time to come. Studying the Janul multitude drawn up before them, Luminara made a hasty estimate of their numbers. Less than 1,000, she guessed, but all of them well-armed and clad in striking, hand-worked armor. Standing alongside her, Obi-Wan concurred with her assessment.
No heavy weapons.
He leaned slightly forward as he carefully scrutinized the tightly packed lines of warriors.
No laser cannons, no launchers of any size.
He remarked on this to Bayar. Their friend looked horrified.
Aja, no! If either the Baroki or the Janul were to employ such deadly off-world devices, one clan or the other might well win this and all other similar confrontations, but they would be shunned by every other clan on the planet. Besides, such an escalation would mean that the opposing side would have to acquire similar weapons to defend itself. And then where would the proud Alwari be?
Staring down the barrel of self-extermination, Anakin ventured from nearby.
Though he would never have admitted to it, he personally found the barbaric display, with armored Ancyonians riding equally flamboyantly garbed Sadanes and a few magnificently invested Subatars, oddly beguiling. From a purely academic point of view, of course, he hastened to assure himself. While today's confrontation might mean a great deal to its Ancyonian participants, To him, it was only another episode in his education. Barring, of course, the possibility that he and his friends might die.
So, these are the Janul.
Luminara indicated the masked warriors.
They are pretty impressive.
Along with the Situng Baroki, the Hovsgald Janul have always been one of the overclans, yes, Bayar admitted. But with your help, the matter of who reigns truly supreme among the Alwari will finally be settled.
I hope so, Obi-Wan told him quietly. That's what we're here today to decide, by setting an example for both the Baroki and the Janul.
Now, that seemed a strange thing to say, Bayar thought. But then, the flat-eyed off-worlders often seemed to speak in riddles. Having been ordered to stay out of the fight and remain back with the non-combatants, Kyakta and Bulgan were in an agony of frustration. They had promised their lives to the off-worlders who had helped them, and yet now they would be forced to stand and watch as their new friends risked their lives on behalf of fellow Alwari. It was almost too much to bear. Tuki, on the other hand, had no difficulty whatsoever in agreeing to stay out of the forthcoming fight.
There are only four of them.
From their vantage point, slightly higher up on the hill overlooking the river and the Janul encampment, Kyakta strained to see.
Strong and skilled as they are, how can our friends possibly make a difference in the midst of a battle among so many?
I don't know. Bulgan rubbed nervously at his eye patch. But you know as well as I that these off-worlders are full of surprises.
Tuki know what going happen.
The too much bigger Alwari turned to look down at him.
Jedi going do something stupid.
He moved to the edge of the slight overlook, trying to keep Barriss in view. Frowning, Kyakta was sorely tempted to smack the little Gwaran.
You're lucky Master Luminara ordered me not to hit you. You should show some respect. Whatever happens, I'm sure they're not going to allow themselves to be killed. Their mission here is too important to them.
Tuki looked back up at him.
Who say something's about them get killed? Tuki not say that.
The Gwaran returned his attention to the unfolding spectacle below.
Tuki say they do stupid. Maybe they think of something stupid to do all over stupid heads of Alwari.
The guides exchanged a confused glance with the equally puzzled Bayar. Then, realizing that it was a waste of time to try to make sense of something as patently nonsensical as Gwaran gibberish, they all moved to the edge of the slight overlook, the better to follow the proceedings unfolding below. Up close, the savage spectacle was even more impressive than it was from the top of the hill. Having arrayed themselves in their triple defensive line opposite the Baroki force, the assembled Janul presented a panoply of pugnacious attire and attitude. War paint adorned their faces, bare heads, and rippling manes. Leather and composite armor was festooned with individual, family, and clan ornamentation. In addition to traditional bows and arrows, throwing spears, and swords, they carried imported blasters and rifles. Their grim expressions were those of people bent on defeating any attackers, no matter the possible cost. Forming a solid line opposite the arrivals, the soldiers of the Baroki offered a no less striking display. Flaunting attitude as well as weapons, individual warriors jostled for position, each heavily armed male striving to gain a place near the front. Clan leaders mounted on rearing sadanes took up their forward positions, shouting instructions to their troops. The air was thick with anticipation and the Ancyonian equivalent of adrenaline. Gazing down from the crest of the hill, the apprehensive Kyakta and Bulgan saw that full, unrestrained combat could break out at any moment. Standing between them, Tuki was unnaturally silent.